This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
One more time. All right. Lots of energy in the room this morning. Wonderful. Welcome, welcome, welcome to this second installment of our series on Islam. So I want to introduce our speaker here in just a moment, but also just to remind you that this microphone here is so that our Zoom audience can hear. So if you have a question or a comment, please come to this microphone at the appropriate time so that our Zoom audience can hear the question. Today we have Dr. Hena Azam, who is the Associate Professor of Islamic Studies in the Department of Middle Eastern Studies at UT Austin. Her research interests are in women and gender in Islam, Islamic law and ethics, the teaching of Islamic studies, and Islam in America. She teaches a wide range of courses in Islamic and Middle Eastern studies and serves as the graduate advisor for the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at UT. Outside of teaching and research, she's very interested in the interdependency between democracy, sustenance, human rights, and civil society. She's on the steering committee for the Jefferson Center in Core Texts and Ideas, through which she organizes Sustaining Democracy, a reading and discussion group for students at UT Austin. She has a book, Sexual Violation in Islamic Law, and it won the 2016 American Historical Association Award for Pre-Modern History. And in 2019, UT's Alcalade named Dr. Azam as one of the Texas 10. And in 2021, she was given honorable mention by the International Middle Eastern Studies Association for excellence in undergraduate teaching. So without further ado, Dr. Hena Azam.
Okay, am I louder now? Okay, great. Well, thank you all so much for coming to this morning's talk. And I want to thank also St. David's for putting on this series. I wish that more religious communities, including the Muslim community, would take the effort to invite people of other religions to come and explain their ideas. It's very heartwarming that you all are taking the effort to do this. So I want to thank you for that. So I had an opportunity to just look at the slides, not the Zoom presentation of the previous, and am I speaking loudly enough? Okay, if anybody has difficulty, let me know and I can shout, but the Zoom people may not like that. Yes, I had an opportunity to just review the slides for the previous speaker's presentation. So I have some idea of what he covered, and I'm going to try to like not just repeat that material, but rather build on it. So my talk today is on ethics in Islam. And the smaller text there is concepts, sources, and content. So I have a lot of slides. I don't think we're going to be able to get through all of them, but I'm just going to get through sort of the first main sort of theoretical part of the presentation, and then see if we have some time to look at some of the passages in the Quran directly that refer to ethics, right? Because I always like primary text work. We have at least one teacher. You get into the meat of it. It's like, I want to see what the text says itself rather than just what somebody else says it says, right? Okay. Okay, great. So based on the slides that I saw, the previous speaker kind of gave an overview of theology, that is like basic beliefs about like God and the nature of the world, right? Like cosmology. And worship, I saw that he covered like the five pillars of worship, right? Prayer and fasting and all that. And then I saw that there was, now I don't know how far he got in his slides because, you know, there are a lot of slides and we always tend to have more slides than we can actually get through, but it looks like he covered some basic moral principles. Yeah. Okay. So, So what I'm going to do today is kind of dive deeper into that last section, morality or ethics, kind of go into that with more detail. And we can think of ethics, morality, kind of as interchangeably, as referring to principles of conduct, as opposed to belief, right? And so, for example, you know, five different people may have five different reasons to, you know, to not steal, right? But at the end of the day, they all end up not stealing, for example, right? So their theology and beliefs get into sort of a different place. We're sort of going to focus on what the actual moral principles are. I actually am working on a piece. My next book project has to do with ethics in the Quran. And so just to be a little bit more precise, when we use the word ethics and morality interchangeably, we're playing fast and loose with the philosophical terminology. Really, it is ethics covers a lot of things, and it is normative ethics that we are referring to when we talk about morality. In other words, that portion of ethics that tells us what we should do or should not do, that's called normative ethics. But it's too long for me to keep saying normative ethics, so I'll just shorten it to ethics. Okay. Even though I'm not texting, I still like to take shortcuts when I speak. Okay. All right. So when we're talking about Islamic ethics or morality, we're talking about beliefs, but not beliefs about God or the nature of the cosmos, but rather beliefs about morality, beliefs about right and wrong conduct, about what one should do. And we are talking about directives, injunctions, instructions, but they're not instructions on how to pray or how to fast. The Quran and the life of Muhammad and so forth has a lot about how to pray and how to fast, but we're talking about interpersonal relations when we talk about ethics. That's not to say that all aspects of morality or ethics it doesn't mean that we only do it for other people, but how we conduct ourselves morally has implications for other people, right? That's kind of what we mean. Okay. So I want to back up a little bit into how Muslim moral philosophers have thought about interpersonal ethics or interpersonal relations. The Muslim moral philosophers divided all acts into one of two types. And there are certain actions that actually crossed types. And in fact, that's probably the case for most. But most acts kind of fell more into one category or another. Now, what were these two categories? The first category is what they called the rights of God. In other words, acts that fulfill or violate the rights of God. So acts that concern the rights of God are like prayer. If I'm fasting during the month of Ramadan, it doesn't really do anything for anybody else, right? Nobody else benefits. Nobody else is harmed, right? If I'm praying, I mean, it may make me a better person. It may make me a worse person. Who knows? But I mean, the purpose of prayer is not really directly related to anybody else, right? When we talk about freedom of religion, that's what we're talking about. Anybody can pray the way they want to, because it doesn't impact anybody else. Pilgrimage. If I go for Hajj, it doesn't make any difference to anybody else compared to if I went to Hawaii for a beach vacation, right? Like, it doesn't really concern anybody. So the jurists, the scholars, the moral philosophers recognize that, and they refer to all of those types of worship practices as pertaining to the rights of God. No other human being really has a stake in one's fulfillment or violation of the rights of God. Then there's the other category of acts, which they said pertain to the rights of creatures. Oh, am I supposed to be facing the owl this whole time? Okay, because then I have to stay back over here. Okay, it'll find me. All right. So it's sometimes they're referred to as the rights of creatures, the rights of persons, the rights of those are the two basic ways they're referred to in Arabic. I don't like to use the rights of humans, i.e. human rights, which is actually how it would translate, because then it gets muddled up and confused with modern terminology on human rights, although they overlap, interestingly enough. But just to avoid that, we'll call it, you know, interpersonal rights or creaturely rights. So these concern acts in social life, marriage, family life, economy, finance, governance, warfare, contracts, trade, judgments and punishments, treatment of animals and the environment. I added in animals and the environment at the end. Why? Because in the Islamic worldview, humans are not the only creatures that have been created by God, right? So animals and plants and waterfalls, all that stuff sort of fits into creatures. So there are actions that we do that concern the rights of God and actions that concern the rights of creatures. So this is an interesting terminology, right? It's basically saying that all of these other creatures have rights that I am morally obligated to uphold, and that I am also capable of violating or transgressing, right? So it's kind of an interesting way to think about morality, you know? So the way that Muslims will often speak of it based on the Quran is they'll say that the poor have rights on the wealthy, right? The poor have rights on the wealthy. Every person of means actually has a moral obligation to share some of their wealth with some who are poor, right? And that's a right. It's hardwired into the religion. You have to give it, kind of like alms or like tithing. Okay, so my focus today is on sort of this part here, right? Not so much on the rights of God. Does that terminology make sense to everybody? Okay, great. So now there is a common thread between the rights of God and the rights of persons or rights of creatures. And that common thread is virtue or good character, right? So think about it this way. A person of good character would excel in maintaining both the rights of God and the rights of creatures, right? So language about character and virtue is not about the actions, but about the qualities of the person. A person who is conscientious about fulfilling their promises would probably be conscientious about fulfilling their promises to God and also their promises to other people, for example, right? So virtue or character, you can think of that as like the bridge between how we respond to God and how we respond to others. Is that making sense? Okay. So for example, an ethical command could be, you know, don't steal from your neighbor, don't destroy your neighbor's property, right? That's kind of framed as a rule. Do this, don't do that, right? That's different from a virtue, right? A virtue is a quality that inheres in a person that would be, you know, something like honesty or justice, right? A person who has inculcated that value in themselves would likely say, well, it would be unjust for me to go and steal or destroy my neighbor's property, right? So some examples of virtues that are highly emphasized in the Quran and in the Islamic tradition are truthfulness. Can you read this text? I was so worried about this earlier. And nobody comes sits in the front rows ever, except you. Thank you so much. So you can read the small text. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so like truthfulness, generosity, modesty, humility, courage, justice, steadfastness. There are other virtues and values also that are mentioned in the Quran and in the Muslim tradition, but these are ones that tend to get there's a lot of focus on them in the Quran. And those of you who are familiar with the ancient Greek tradition, Plato, Aristotle, and so forth, might recognize some of these, right? Justice, courage, right? Those are also spoken of in the Greek tradition. And in fact, there's actually quite a bit of overlap between the ancient Greek tradition, the medieval Christian tradition, and then the Islamic tradition when it comes to moral philosophy and ethics, because they all took from the same source, you know. So those of you who are familiar with history will know that in the period after sort of like the end of ancient Greece, and we get into Rome, then we get to the fall of Rome, and then comes the rise of Islam, the Arabs become very interested in sort of reviving the ancient Greek tradition. And so the Muslim emperors start employing those of their people, their citizens who are learned in ancient Greek. So just take a wild guess. Which of the Muslim imperial subjects would have been familiar with ancient Greek? Right, and what religion might they have been? Christian, right? So the Muslim emperors, when they became very interested in reviving the ancient Greek philosophical tradition and political theoretical tradition and a variety of other sort of Greek ideas, employed Christians who were learned in Greek and also Syriac and other languages and so forth to sort of go back and translate those ancient Greek texts, which were basically being ignored in Europe at the time, into Arabic. So then you had Arab Muslims and Jews and Christians sort of ingesting all of this ancient Greek material, Plato, Aristotle, Plotinus, you name it, and then coming up with really interesting sort of, and applying those ideas towards their own religious tradition. So then you see an explosion in the medieval period of Jewish, Christian, and Islamic thought that is sort of taking ancient Greek categories and combining them with their scriptural readings. So anyway, that's another whole fascinating history. And is anybody familiar with some of that stuff that I just said? I saw a couple of nods. Yeah, it's really great stuff. Okay, so sorry, I better continue. Okay, so I'm gonna run out of time. All right, so virtues and characters, that's where this fits into this picture of like rights of God, rights of persons, and morality and ethics. Okay. So the term term Islamic morality or Islamic ethics, as I'm using it then, refers to both that which the Islamic sources have established as correct conduct, especially vis-a-vis other creatures, also God, but for focusing on creatures, and also virtues and vices that are identified by the Islamic sources as marks of either good character or poor character. That's sort of a summation statement. Okay, now you might have noticed, like even in the slide just before, that I avoid saying things like Islam says this, X, or Islam commands or prohibits Y. That's part of, you know, our academic training, is that we're not supposed to say Islam says, because there's no one Islam, right? What we find, in fact, is that there is variation among what different Muslim scholars, whether they be theologians or jurists or philosophers or mystics, we have to include mystics as well, have said about good conduct and good character. And the reason for this variation is that ethics, whatever ethical formula one develops or articulates, is based in part on interpretations of the scriptural sources, right? Oh, this would help if I did this, right? Based on interpretation of the scriptural sources. So different people could interpret the same text differently. No surprise there, right? Okay, so now I want to move into what those scriptural or textual sources are. And if this is this very repetitive? of what the previous speaker said. Okay, all right, good. Okay, so the first source, the Quran. I know he mentioned the Quran, but we're gonna have hopefully a chance to read a little bit, a few passages, if I can move more quickly. You're not interrupting me, I'm interrupting myself. So the first source is the Quran, that is seen as the most authoritative for Muslims, right? Not surprisingly, it is regarded as being divine speech. I mean, God, that means God's own words. The Quran was revealed, Muslims believe, revealed to Muhammad during the 23-year period of his prophetic career. This is the 7th century CE, just to sort of place us in time, in case some of you didn't know. The Quran was canonized shortly after Muhammad's death, within about 20 years, and it's essentially unchanged since then. So the Quran is in a poetic, formal Arabic. Arabic is a very interesting language, right? So Arabic has not, it has and has not undergone the types of linguistic changes that typically happen with languages, right? Probably not unlike, you know, ancient Greek, Syriac, or Latin, or even biblical Hebrew, right? When you have languages that are scriptural in nature, they're anchored into the scripture. So they don't shift the way that languages normally do, right? It's languages that are only spoken, or maybe they're written, but they're not tied to some sort of a belief that a religious or holy text. You know, people don't mind messing around with the language, or it doesn't matter that much. But when you have a religious scripture, the community is invested in making sure that they can continue to understand that scripture. And furthermore, many religions hold that prayer must be conducted in that scriptural language, right? So there's all sorts of reasons why scriptures tend to like anchor a language in place, but the people, they're still talking, they're still changing. So Arabic is a really strange language in the sense that there's a formal version of Arabic that is found in the Quran and that continues to be utilized today in formal settings. And then there's a spoken or dialect, not just one, many dialects of Arabic across the Arab world that are so different from formal Arabic that if one only knows formal Arabic, you actually can't understand what the people are saying. And also, if you are from one edge of the Muslim world, like from Morocco, and you listen to somebody from Iraq, you also can't necessarily understand them. So the formal Arabic ends up functioning also to help keep the Arab world together. Without the Quran, I think it might be fair to say that without the Quran, we wouldn't have an Arab world today, because the languages would have separated out so much. Like Latin, right? You have Spanish, you have French, you have Italian, right? I mean, they're different languages. They're far enough apart that they are different languages. But the Quran has held them all together. So this is the first source. The Quran is considered to be the divine word. The second major source for Islamic morality, moral or ethics, is Muhammad. Muhammad's way of being. And I put that in quotations because this concept of a way of being, the word for that in Arabic is sunnah, S-U-N-N-A. I don't know, did he mention the word sunnah? Okay, he may have mentioned Muhammad as an example or like a, right? But so I'm introducing this new word sunnah, which is used by Muslims to refer to Muhammad's way of being. Now, Muhammad is not the only person who had a way of being. Every single person has a way of being. You know your kids, you just know the way they are. You know your parents, you know your spouse, right? You know your friends, your close friends. You even know your enemies, right? People you don't like, I know how they are, right? So everybody has a sunnah. Muhammad also has a sunnah. And interestingly, the Quran speaks about God having a sunnah. God has a certain way of acting that you can sort of rely on, right? God means well for his creatures. He's not going to one day get up and be like, well, today I really, you know, I want to screw them over. So God has a sunnah. The world has a sunnah. The created world has a sunnah. There are ways that clouds behave. there are ways that trees grow, right? So everything has a sunnah, but for the purposes of Islamic ethics, it's Muhammad's sunnah that is considered to be the second major source after the Quran. And that is because Muhammad was seen as being the highest example of piety and good character for Muslims. So Muslims, observant Muslims, seek to follow or emulate the sunnah of Muhammad. Now, there's a little bit of a problem, which is that Muhammad is no longer with us. He passed away a long time ago. And even if a person were alive at the same time that he was alive, it doesn't necessarily mean that they knew him personally or all that well. Right? So one cannot actually consult Muhammad's sunnah directly. But what we can consult are reports about what Muhammad said and did. Accounts. So Muhammad's companions, those who knew him at the time, kind of after his death or even during his lifetime, busied themselves with reporting. Somebody mute their. Yes. Somebody's playing video games. Okay, so I'm sure he wasn't that excited about what I was talking about. Okay, so, So Muslims, the companions of Muhammad sort of handed down, disseminated reports, and then those reports ended up being handed down through the generations, right? So there are thousands of these. A lot of people knew Muhammad. He was not just a religious figure. He was also a head of state, right? He established a community, a large congregation. You know, a lot of people knew him. So there are thousands and thousands of hadiths that have been handed down. And after a couple of generations, there were scholars who made it their business to compile these hadiths. So there are many collections of hadiths. They don't always have the same hadiths in them. One person's compilation could have different things than another person's compilations, but these compilations altogether are seen as holding the sunnah, which itself is not tangible. Does that make sense? So in other words, we could say, you know, what would Muhammad do? And it's really an idea. Everybody has a certain idea of what Muhammad was like. But you can't then point to it and say, there it is, right? I've got video. It's not going to work. You have to kind of like make the case that this is what Muhammad would do. So this is the second source of Islamic ethics. So the hadiths and the Quran together are referred to as Islamic scriptures and are the basis for all sorts of Islamic thought, Islamic theology, mysticism, rules regarding worship, ritual, dietary rules like not eating pork and all that stuff, and also Islamic morality and law. And then all those scriptures also have commentaries. There's a huge commentary tradition that developed over the centuries. And interestingly, the study of both the Quran and the Hadiths are connected to ancillary sciences or disciplines that are not directly religious in nature. For example, the study of Arabic poetry. Linguistics, history, biography. Now you can ask later if you like, what does poetry have to do with Quran? We can get into that later, but it's just interesting to know how the Quran and the Hadiths have been utilized in Muslim life historically and how they have functioned as sources, not only for religion, but also for other sort of secular or non-religious fields of study. Okay, so over time, they're developed different scriptural interpretations, different interpretive techniques. And then because there were like different teachers who had different ways of interpreting the texts, there emerged these distinct schools of thought, right? And then within those schools of interpretation, there came to be books, school texts, right, where certain scholars would write what they thought was the correct understanding of the Quran and the correct understanding of the Sunnah. And then they had disciples, and then those disciples would carry on to the traditions of those schools. So there are different schools in pretty much every aspect of Islamic life. But it is important to understand that all the different interpretations still drew on those scriptures, right? So they all could be called Islamic, even though they may differ in content. Hang in with me so far? Yes. Very familiar. Very familiar. But sometimes, you know, people, they're familiar with how things work in their own, but from the outside, another religion can look like it's more unified or more coherent or more monolithic. And sometimes it's kind of interesting to see, well, oh, they have the same problems too, you know. And then it's so interesting, like in the modern period, you'll recognize this one too. Sometimes, one will ask a person, well, you know, okay, so you're Muslim. So like, which school of law or theology do you follow? And then there's the great answer, I'm just Muslim, right? That's got to sound familiar to some people, right? I'm just Christian. As if you have no, wait, what? You came straight from, 2000 centuries ago and just popped up over here with no development along there. You're not climbing on the shoulders of anybody who went before you. No, you just got it straight. You know, same thing with this, with Islam. And I'm just Muslim. It's like, well, no, I mean, Muhammad didn't speak to you last time I checked. So where are you getting your ideas from, right? Everyone has a lineage. Everyone has a lineage. And what's important is to understand that lineage. So now we've been using the term Islamic morality, Islamic ethics. Those are English words. What do Muslims use? What is used in Arabic? So the term for good character, that whole virtue part of the discussion, is akhlaq. To make life difficult for you, it includes both the ha and the qaf. So you can really have a nice hard time pronouncing the word. But it's okay, there's no test here. So akhlaq means good character. In other words, having excellence of conduct or virtuous conduct. And akhlaq is very, very important in Muslim cultures and Muslim societies. The vast majority of Muslims haven't read the Quran. Even those who are Arab haven't read the Quran. Even if they read the Quran, they couldn't necessarily understand it because of that diglossy I was talking about earlier, where the language of the Quran is different from the language of, it's the reason why we ultimately had vernacular versions of the Bible, because not everybody could read, you know, at a certain point what was in the older text. So for many Muslims, for most Muslims, what being Muslim means is, or being a good Muslim means is you do your worship, the prayer and the fasting stuff, and then you have good character. That's about it, right? I mean, and so it's taken very seriously. Okay, be truthful, be respect your parents, be helpful to your neighbor, that kind of stuff, right? Okay. And so this is that list. It's the same list. I was just, going quickly. So of some of the virtues that constitute akhlaq. Okay, so akhlaq means good character or excellence in virtuous conduct. Okay, the term for the fulfillment of the rights of God and creatures, that is referred to in Islamic parlance. There's some chairs up here. Yeah, come. Everyone's so afraid of the speaker. Actually, there's 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah. So I'll step back so as not to be too close. Okay. The term for that sort of rights fulfillment, or the delineation of the rights that need to be fulfilled, is Sharia. Raise your hand if you've heard the word Sharia. Yay! Okay, so I wanted to actually, I even wrote to myself a note. Okay, so the Sharia is the moral rules that one must follow in order to uphold the rights of God and of others. Okay, that's sort of a quick definition of it, but I want to stop and think about this term because we hear it all the time. So typically, we hear it as something that's bad or frightening. Even if we don't personally feel bad or frightened, that's how it's how it kind of like runs through the air, right? The airwaves is it something that's bad or frightening? It about Muslims taking over the legal system or something like that, right? Who's kind of run into that sort of idea, right? Okay, so that's the reason why I was just looking this up last night. As of 2017 or 2018, we could count over 200 efforts to ban Sharia law in the U.S. Now, remember, Sharia for a Muslim means things like praying and fasting and being good to your parents. I don't think people really want to ban Sharia law. But there's just a lack of understanding about it. So I want to ask just the three questions that I'm putting forward here is, what is Sharia or Sharia law, which I gave this sort of quick definition of up here. Why is there confusion about it? And then the big question that was in my little abstract, which I think was put out there, is following Sharia compatible with following US law? Right? Good questions. You know, and I mean, it's, you know, we have to ask, you know, because we hear about things like, you know, Muslim women wanting to have the right to wear a headscarf, right? And like, what is it, like when they're competing in the Olympics? Okay, so what's happening over there? The things like that, right? Okay, so it's very interesting that the term for Islamic moral law is Sharia. Okay, notice here, I said Sharia equals Islamic moral law. And then in the next slide, I said Sharia does not mean Islamic law. Okay, now that's tricky because Muslims, even Muslim scholars like myself, translate Sharia as Islamic law. And here I am saying that's not what it means. Okay, this is such a tangle. Okay, so translating Sharia as Islamic law leads to confusion, I believe, because when we in the US use the word law, we're not using it the way that medieval Muslims and Jews use the word like Jewish law or Islamic law. And the Christian tradition doesn't have a strong tradition of Christian law. There's canon law, but it only governed what was happening in the church, right? So, I mean, we give to Caesar what is Caesar's. The relationship between state and law is different in Christianity than it is in Islam or Judaism or even other religions. Okay, so when we as Americans use the term law, what we really mean is the law of the land or what is enforced by the state. There's a whole apparatus of law enforcement officials and courts and the prison system and also fines and all of that. That is what we usually mean when we use the word law. We don't use the word law to refer to personal moral beliefs or practices, right? Even if a person held themselves to be morally obligated to tell the truth, we wouldn't usually call that an aspect of the law, right? So using the word law is, it kind of leads to confusion, I think, for those who hear it, especially those who are, you know, in the US. But still, for many, even though they may not use the word law to refer to like personal moral beliefs and practices, there is a kind of, I believe, a porous border between law and morality, because I think most Americans even still believe that they should sort of mirror each other, right? There should be a resonance. So the law should sort of mirror what is morally justified, right? I mean, anybody who's ever gone out there to like knock on doors for a campaign or to like try to get a law changed. Why? We don't try to get laws changed just because we think it's a good way to spend, you know, our hard-earned rest time. It's because we feel like, oh, there's a problem here, that the law is not aligning with morality. And so we want to get the law changed because we feel that they should mirror one another. So it's kind of a porous border, even for, as a matter of fact, the more open a society, the more democratic, the more open, the more porous that border gets. Because in a dictatorship, in a monarchy, civilians have no say over the laws of their country. So they're accustomed to a massive divide between what the law of the land is and what they believe is morally correct. But the more freedom there is, the more the people have a say in their laws, the more they have a say in their legislation, the more they can vote, the more all sorts of stuff happens. So the fact that we are all at each other's throats trying to change laws this way and that way and this way and that way actually is a good sign. It really is. I hate where we're at in some ways in our country right now, but I would be much more worried if we were silent. I'd be much more worried if we weren't saying anything. It would not mean that we are happy. It would mean that we are oppressed, right? Okay. So there's this poor, but this is the thing is that a lot of Americans don't realize the porosity of that border between law and morality. But when they hear Muslims talking about it, it's like, oh, what are they doing? But we all do it, right? So most of us hold to a higher law than the state law. We call that divine law. We may call it natural law because there are people who don't believe in God who still have a sense of morality. They may not call it divine law. They may call it just natural law and say that, you know, all humans are endowed with certain inalienable rights. You can believe that even if you are not, you can believe in human rights, even if you don't believe in God. And you can believe that there's that higher law, right? That we all should aspire to make our common law, our state law, align with. Okay, so Sharia for Muslims is that moral, i.e. divine or natural law, that Muslims live by even if the state doesn't enforce it. For example, Muslims, observant Muslims, will pray even though the state doesn't enforce it, it doesn't prohibit it. What Muslims don't want is for it to be prohibited, right? We want the state to just not say anything about it. And then certain people can say Merry Christmas and other people can say Mubarak and it's okay, right? So prayer, fasting, and then there's dietary things like abstaining from wine or pork or eating. Muslims have something like kosher in terms of a certain way that meat is supposed to be slaughtered in order for it to be ethical or moral for us to eat it. So having those rules, chastity, right? No sex outside of marriage and things like that. The state doesn't enforce it, upholding promises, speaking the truth. Okay, right? So we get an idea of how Muslims can believe in Sharia law, Islamic law, in Sharia, and even live by it and not be contravening US law, right? The way that we all do. We all have personal morality, right? Furthermore, and this is really important, it is not the duty or even the right of Muslims, according to Islamic jurisprudence, to impose Sharia on others, especially non-Muslims. Okay, I as an individual citizen cannot, and I'm not saying cannot because the police will or the FBI will come and get me, but because as a Muslim, I cannot, in Islamic thinking, I cannot impose the law on another person who is Muslim, because I don't have standing, because I am not the government, because I am an ordinary citizen. The example that I give in my classes is jihad, because everyone's afraid about jihad, right? War, warfare, terrorism, right? I, as an ordinary Muslim citizen, cannot with a bunch of my other Muslim friends say, we're going to war against Cuba. That's it, we're doing it. I mean, it makes no sense. I am not the army. I'm not the military. I'm not the state. I have no right because in Islamic law, jihad can only be carried out by a state. There's no non-governmental jihad. There is no non-governmental warfare. Non-governmental actors who commit acts of like military offense and military actions are called terrorists in Islamic law. Now, that sounds familiar, right? Because in American law, me and a bunch of my friends can't go to war against Cuba either. We don't have standing, right? So it is not the duty or the right of Muslims to impose Sharia on other Muslims because we don't have standing. It is not our right to impose Sharia on non-Muslims ever. You can never do it. Even like go back into the medieval period, right? So there's a whole thing called the millet system. It was used in Muslim empires. It was also used in non-Muslim empires and Christian empires and so forth, where basically religious minority communities operated in a sort of autonomous fashion under the laws of the state in their own communities. They did have to pay taxes, but they also they kind of governed themselves. So in terms of their life and personal morality and all of that. So that's an important thing to know. So the legal battles that we hear flying around over Sharia are never for the reason that the Muslims in such and such place, such and such state or city or county are busy trying to impose Sharia law. Look into any case you hear about. Any place you hear that there's an anti-Sharia ban or bill or something, there's actually no incident of Muslims trying to impose Sharia. It's sort of like, well, that's just a good reason to get votes or something. Where you do see the battles are where Muslims are trying to achieve the same rights that others have. So for example, parents wanting their Muslim children to be able to miss school on Eid day so that they can go and attend services for their religious holidays in the same way that it's been, you know, in our system already for other religions, right, forever. So that's where we see a lot of those battles over Sharia. Okay, so where am I on time? Make sure I can get through my slides. Am I at 45 minutes? Okay, so I got to wrap up quickly here. Okay, so I'm almost done. We won't get to the Quran verses because I want to have conversation. I can always send those to you later. So this is not to say some elements of Sharia do become state law in majority Muslim countries. In part because laws of a land always tend to reflect the dominant class or dominant group in a society. But even there, the Sharia legislation is often contested and there's backs and forths and so forth. So that's in majority Muslim countries. Now I want to talk about Muslims in America. Okay, American Muslims, this is going to strike people as strange. American Muslims, no matter how observant, no matter how religious, no matter how conservative they are, American Muslims are definitionally secular. Why? Because the idea of secularism is the separation of church and state, religion and state. Every single Muslim in America, no matter how religious they are, they don't even know this. Because we don't think of the word secular this way, but every single Muslim in America has already agreed to and is living according to laws that are not religious. Then they've already agreed to live that way, right? They've already accepted the separation. That's why they're here. And that's why they're here and not in jail, right? Because they're already living according to the separation. So it's an interesting thing to think about. So I'm going to stop there. I had this whole other part where we look at some verses, but we don't have time for that because I think I've introduced a lot of material here that, you know, these are just kind of examples of verses that talk about justice and virtue and generosity. And like there's a whole bunch of material here, but I can always share the slide show with your community. But I'll just stop there so that we can have some time for questions. Yeah. And whoopsie. There's that. Oh, yeah.
So my question is it seems like one of the places that we see clash is over the importance of not defaming a deity in the view of what it means to like make fun of Jesus versus making fun of Muhammad in the secular world.
Yeah.
Could you say a little bit about the ethical principles that underlie some of that? And believe me, I know Christians vary
in, yeah, of course,
in that as well. But
of course,
a little bit where I see that clash in Europe or here seems to have a big moral underpinning.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to repeat questions just to make sure everyone can hear them. The question was, what can I say about sort of the Islamic ethics around insulting or speaking of the sort of the deities or prophets of other religions, gods or prophets of other religions, right? So that's an interesting question. So during the lifetime of Muhammad, there were actually, the vast majority of Arabians at the time were not monotheists. They were polytheists or pagans, and they were really offended by what Muhammad was saying because he was seen as insulting their gods. And so sometimes they would come and they would insult him and his God, which is, you know, Allah, or, you know, the idea of the one God, right? Sometimes they would, you know, deface property, right? So they would come to the mosque that he had established. There's one case of a guy coming in and urinating in the mosque, which is, you know, for Muslims, that's kind of a bad thing. I mean, it's kind of bad for even like any place, right? Except maybe like my barn. I guess you can come in and urinate in my barn. And he people would get really upset. They're like, should we go and apprehend the person or bring him to you? And he always said, just let them go. You know, I mean, I'm not. So that's that forbearance, right? Talking about a virtue, right? The ability to kind of see beyond what a person might be doing out of their ignorance, right? And not react, not be reactive in that way. So those are some examples from the Sunnah, from Muhammad's own life. As far as the Quran goes, the Quran, in terms of how Muslims should behave, the Quran says that Muslims should be very careful not to insult the gods of others, even those that the Quran regards as false gods, right? So the pagan deities were, from the Quranic perspective, just not real. And yet the Quran says not to insult those gods, because then those people might in anger just insult God and not know what they do. They wouldn't realize the enormity of what they're doing because they would just be tit for tatting. So now it doesn't change the fact that people have feelings, and people have feelings about their religion and get very worked up if they feel that somebody has defamed or insulted their religion. There's also a lot of machismo that comes into play, you know, like, how dare you, you know, mess with whatever. So there's all sorts of reasons for why those happen. Those kind of like responses occur around the world. But it is, one can say safely, it is always bad to insult another person's religion, especially their gods. Just don't do it. I mean, that's different from respectfully disagreeing. And I hope that we always can, right? We should be able to enter into very vigorous debate about our theological differences, but always with the, you know, resort to name calling or insults or, you know, mudslinging and things like that. Does that make sense? Does that answer? Great.
Wondering if the Quran addresses how a woman should dress in public, and also if Muhammad in his practices ever addressed that.
Yes. Oh, great. So the question is, what does the Quran and also Muhammad or the Sunnah have to say about women's dress? So the Quran does have a passage or two that tell women to pull their cloaks around themselves. And those who kind of look into like the history of clothing and also just sort of Muslim tradition has sort of held, that those cloaks in had also head coverings, or that there was a head covering that went with it. So a respectable woman at the time would have sort of covered her head and covered her clothing and covered her body. And the Quran also alludes to this and says, okay, pull your cloaks around yourself. Especially, the attention is not actually to the head, to the hair in the Quran, but the chest. So keep your bosoms covered is essentially how you could say it. And then there is in the Sunnah, there's also a passage or an account where the Prophet saw one of the women was wearing clothing that was a little translucent. The fabric was sort of translucent. And he instructed her to wear clothing that was not see-through, not translucent. So the general kind of principle that we get about women's clothing and men's clothing actually is that it should cover your private parts, but the definition of private parts differs for men and women. It should be loose fitting and it should be not see-through material. So what the rules are then for women includes the hair as well as the body. And then for men, it doesn't include the hair and it's not as much of the body. And then there are differences. The reason why, well, the question over why Muslim women do or do not, or may not cover their hair, like I'm not covering my hair, right? There's all sorts of reasons for those things. But there are those who may not cover their hair because they are not religious, but there are even religious women who still may not cover their hair because of questions of, well, what was the purpose of it? Was the purpose of it to be considered modest? That seems to be what the purpose is in the Quran. But if you look around at our society today, the level of modesty has gone so, so, so low that having one's hair showing is not putting you in danger of being immodest, right? So that's kind of how Muslim women who are observant but don't cover their hair would think about it. And a lot of times they would say that in today's society, to cover your hair doesn't actually convey that you're modest. It just conveys that you're Muslim. That's all it means to people, right? So, yes.
I'm ignorant of how leaders are chosen in Islamic countries. And I would like a little bit of explanation on that and whether they usually reflect the values, the virtues of the Islamic people they rule.
That is such a great question. So the question is about how leaders are selected or chosen in Muslim countries and whether or not they reflect the values of the people that they rule over, that they govern. So there's no one way that leaders of heads of state are selected in Muslim countries. In some places there are elections. In most countries there are elections now at the sort of municipal level or at the sort of the county or city level. But the head of state is only elected in some countries. In other countries, other Muslim countries, there is a monarchy. So the head of state is an inherited position, like in Morocco or Jordan, right? That's the king. And then there are places where supposedly on the books, it's supposed to be a presidency, but it's just a dictator. So it's somebody who is president for life. We all love those. The people who never want to leave office. So that is what's happening. So in Muslim countries, unfortunately, there is a huge problem with dictators, people who just authoritarian leaders who just won't leave office, who just bend the law and install their own people to make sure that the laws are changed to like accommodate their whims and desires and greed and a bunch of things like that. And they also oftentimes hold the military and police forces in their hands to sort of carry out what they want and go after their political opponents. And so there's a lot of imprisonment of political opponents and so forth. So it's a huge problem. It is It's not part of Islamic law. This is all just power and greed. There's not a lot in Islamic, in the Quran, for example, about governance. It didn't seem to be something that, it's just not a big part of it. You know, if you read the Quran, it's mostly about sort of how to live your life. So what I would say it's a huge problem. And then the other part of it is that the United States has also propped up a lot of dictatorial figures in the Middle East because it is easier to get oil rights, for example, when you're only dealing with one person that you can sort of deal with. So this, it's a very, very complicated thing, but it's a great question. So I think we may be at time, right? I can stay a few minutes just to have conversation. I'm happy to, but I want to make sure that people who need to leave for the service or that's coming up are, feel comfortable in doing that. Any other questions? Thank you so much.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.